Let me start and just explain the slide that I'm on. Yes, it's like this. It says adjustment appropriation, select committee to director. As I said, that the presentation that we done is I'll have a few more slides than what I currently are going to present. And those slides that I'm not presenting basically relate to the outcomes of previous year's budget and current spending trends. So, if I can just speak up, the PFMA only allows the adjustment appropriation to make certain specific allocations. If we look at unforeseen and unavoidable expenditures, the definition of unavoidable and unforeseeable expenditure that was not foreseen at the time of the tabling of the budget and is now deemed to be unavoidable. This is add another of the three for expenditure that was not deemed unforeseeable and unavoidable. And those relate to expenditure that although they were not already known when we were finalizing the budget, but we didn't accommodate those allocations in February. Salary adjustments and price increases, and extension of existing services or the creation of new services. Of the 3.8 billion recommended for unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure, 7.4 million is related to natural disasters and animal diseases. And that is comprised of transfers to municipalities and transfers to provincial agricultural departments, and also 100 million to the National Department of Agriculture. And also 46 million of that was for the National Department of Water Affairs and Forestry for flood damage and drought. If we break it down to departments, it's provincial and local governments relating to disaster funding and respect of KZN, as well as the eradication of the bucket system. Treasury budget pressures in the northwest province following boundary changes, and also increased incidences of NDR and SDR, and also the West Coast flood damage. Public service and administration, communication during the public sector strike, which was quite disrupted this year. Education, National Education Recovery Plan, and then health for the comprehensive HIV and AIDS care. Defense, also an allocation for the short of the health sector during the public service strike. Agriculture, for the selling of fish during the swine fever. Housing, emergency housing in the northwest province also related to disasters. And then land affairs, restitution of the risk of health land settlement plan that came through. Public enterprises, also allocation for SAO restructuring, trade and industry for the Kruger IDZ infrastructure commitment, transport for above subsidy shortfall, and then water effect and forestry, as I said, for flood-related damage. Amount that announced in the 2007 budget that also provided for an adjustment budget. There are two items in the category included, 28 million for electrical, mainly for the restructuring, but also for that on the last transfer payment and to electrical, due to a ruling from time, as well as an allocation to the Pebble-based modular reactor, as well and that comprises operational and contractual spending, as well as that on previous years' transfer. Also, a number of rollovers are provided for, and rollovers are funds appropriated but not spent in the previous financial year. Unspent funds for payment for capital assets may only be rolled over to finalize projects or assets where acquisition is already in progress. Savings on transfer payments and subsidies may not be rolled over. Savings and compensation of employers may also not be rolled over. And only 5% of the department's payments for goods and services may be rolled over. And then also, in terms of rollover funds, according to the PFMA, may not be rolled over for more than one financial year, unless the National Treasury has approved them. The rollovers to the department included in the bill is for the presidency, foreign affairs, home affairs, quite a number of departments there. you can look at more at your in your leisure. Then also there was a number of salary adjustments, unfortunately relating to that, in effect of negotiations with governments that in the end can see to a higher increase than initially anticipated. Also self-funding financial expenditure per department is also listed there. The department with their own income is also reflected that in the budget and allocated to that. There's also a slide on the adjusted national budget for the whole of 2007-08. The first column shows the main appropriation in February, the special adjustment appropriation bill that was passed 2 or 3 months ago, the additional appropriation, which is what they have in this bill, and then a completed adjusted order for adjusted appropriation for this year. So, conclusion. Total additional amounts added to the budget equals 16.7 billion. The revised budget framework makes provision for about 5.2 in underspending at a national level in addition to the 3 billion contingency reserve. And the total estimated level of spending rises by 8.5 from a budget of 5.33 to 5.42. And the revised estimate of the budget surplus rises from 10.7 billion to 10.8 or 0.5%.
Thank you, Madam. That's it. Questions?
My biggest problem is on slide number 77 on salary assignments. I see public office, there are only 3 million left. And I don't see how can I improve the whole thing then with this problem.
No, what's your view on the training?
Are they going to get that 500 million back once they have used enough capacity? But also, on the salary adjustment, the other day we were doing again the hearing on education. All the provincial departments are going to understand all personnel, what you call compensation. And I'm not sure, I don't see it here on page 8 where it is catered for. Is there some other arrangement that is going to be done to cater for that? I think Chair, for now, it's my comment, I'll come back.
So how about this? Chair, I just want to, I don't see what Honourable Gordon said about giving the department money and more money and more money. Land Bank one, which has given them, I think, it's over 2 billion. SII Chair is another one. Alex Ford is another one. And I mean, Chair, the CEOs of some of these companies pay themselves performance bonuses of 36 million. And they're running the whole system at a loss. And then they still need money from Treasury. Chair, that's the one question. And then the other one is also on Mr. Sigourney, is the agricultural one with the swan fever and these things. Chair, what happened there was they did pay money. I think the last amount was 88 million, I'm not sure for the figure. But what happened is the Eastern Cape did not supply Treasury with all the necessary documentation they needed to pay out the rest of the money. And that's why some of the money was not paid out. Thank you.
The question, I was raising my hand on, it's not a concern apparently, regarding this unforeseeable, unavoidable expenditure. Looking at the Department of Agriculture in particular, and housing, where we know very well that at times there's always a rollover. But when I looked at the reasons as advanced on page 4, I'm convinced that no, it is possible. But I also want to be sure that looking at page 5, later show that it was a failure in Northwest Province following all the profound changes. Last week we had all these reports that due to those boundary demarcation order, this and that and that was not taken care of. So does this imply that this now is a response to all those concerns? I hope. But more than above that concern, my concern would be, again, in terms of audit. When it comes, does the audit justify these expenditures? I want to check it further. Does this go further to talk to quality expenditure? How does one verify that? Thank you.
Chapter 7 on page 6. Unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditure in respect of water, present forestry. I see here there is provision made for invasion of alien vegetation. I don't know, Chapter, maybe there's another thing that I don't know. As a rural person who sees and looks at these things, you know, those alien plants, herbicides and whatever, to my experience and observation, they are not totally unforeseeable. To me, I would say some kind of sharper and ongoing vigilance by the department coupled with research and development would have just allowed the department to address this matter on the ordinary budget without saying it's been unforeseeable and unavoidable. Especially that element of saying it's unforeseeable. I'm saying my suspicion is that sharper and ongoing vigilance has detected these matters on time so that they could be allocated or catered for in the ordinary budget.
On the housing, I think it was 434 million or 43 million that was taken away from the Eastern Cape. Exactly. Now, the reports were that that money was going to go to Western Province and Northern Cape. Now, further, it was said that that money was going down by those two provinces because they didn't have the capacity to spend the money from the fund that was going to take.
And that ruling is one. We might want to have a discussion with the state-owned enterprise fund together with those sector portfolios. Because I think not much is being done in respect of fashion. Now, let's really not put pressure on the spot. Once they are applying and giving this reason, the pressure. But I think you also are Kali. So the very, very pertinent question that must be directed to be receiving energy. Now, the Eastern Cape thing, Mr. Robert, is still ongoing. It's the issue that relates to brand new money. Kind of still ongoing. The DG was in the Eastern Cape on Friday and Thursday. They're still dealing with the details of that matter. Now, I do want to say for now, let's identify all of the culprits in the deal. I think it's a matter that we must handle in the third quarter. Especially, I think it's difficult in fact. Let's say the JDC must handle some of the national departments. And let's also handle ourselves some of the provincial departments so that we synergize the engagement just in terms of what good things are. At that time, we would be going forward to the new budget. And I suspect some of these things should have been picked up during the MTBDF. And let's have that discussion much broader, just in terms of saying, is everybody ready and capacitated to receive new funding? These adjustments are fine, it's not a big deal, but again, the reason given for the adjustments are a bit problematic for instance. So I'm just saying, can we go the route of saying in the third quarter, let's have a fully fledged discussion with the sector portfolios in preparation for the new budget. Well, looking at the MCBS, these adjustments are minor compared to the new initiatives that are proposed in the MCBS. So that as we engage substantially in a discussion with the receiving department, we then are able to say, we don't think we are ready to receive more money and so on and so on. But there's that kind of ongoing work. But then Madam Ferreira can respond to some of the things she wants to respond to.
Look, I'll try and try best to respond to all the questions. Just on the sister body question, on the SAA... Okay. So I just call them out in the SAA, I should respond to now. But the SAA was rolled over to the SMK, which was ongoing. Then the salary adjustment for education and the underpinning. The salary adjustment specifically relates to the public sector, right? In respect of the disaster management money allocated, we had a number of discussions both with the National Department for Education and the Provincial Department, and it appears that what we've allocated is what they will be able to spend in this year. We will have also passed in additional money in terms of allocation for the next year. So during the budget process for 2008-09, we will reconsider the allocation fee. In respect of the disaster, in the Southern Cape, I'm not exactly, my understanding would be that it would be included in the Northern Cape allocation. So I'm not exactly sure which area, which province does it?
No, don't worry, that's the Western Cape.
Okay, we...
If it is not there, don't worry, it's not there again. I think that's really good and fast. Our own responsibility. I think it's a very fair question to you. It's something that is happening. But the bottom line is that if they have not declared it, it won't
appear. Yeah. Mr. Robertson, the housing question I take is you've indicated that that's still an ongoing process. Just in the land bank, SAA and the lease board, I think we are aware of the difficulties faced by the SOEs and the joint budget. Okay. As far as I understand, Parliament is taking quite an active approach in terms of re-looking at performance there. My understanding of the unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure, I trust that you were satisfied that the allocations that we make don't meet the criteria for unavoidable and unforeseen. And in respect of the Northwest, I understand the adjustments in the borders did create quite a problem in Northwest specifically, because a number of income generating activities were being moved to other provinces. So, and it just suddenly become quite a crisis in respect of their budget. So, but part of that is also better performance management from National Treasury side in terms of fiscal discipline. So in terms of it, we've given them the allocation to address the constraints that they face, but there's also a very clear framework in terms of how they need to restructure their budget processes in terms of making allocations and ensuring accountability for it. So there is a framework that runs with that money in terms of how it needs to be spent. In terms of Mr. Khalifi's question, just an alien legislation one, it is specifically related to the disaster management as well. But as the floods come through, it sort of brings additional alien legislation. I mean, I'm not a specialist on those issues. But as far as I understand, it's specifically interesting to look at the artists with when the floods come in, it brings a specific type of algae that grows unbelievably fast in terms of, you know, if it's exposed to sunlight. So there's a flood coming into that ground. Within 24 hours, it's visible already on the water, and it creates a bad taste, and it sort of covers the top of the dam so that not enough sunlight comes through to support the biodiversity in the dam. But that's just, I mean, I'm probably not explaining it well, but as far as I understand, it's sort of, you know, something that sort of grows on the water within 24 to 48 hours, and if you don't immediately spray it, it causes a severe problem. There's a specific name for it, but I can't now remember the name of the specific algae. Jacinta, yes, that is a disease, yeah. And that is just unforeseen. You can't really prevent it up front. If the flood comes in, it brings just with it. So hopefully I did answer these some of the questions.
No, no. The issue is really, I'm all hands-on. Which are sometimes performance issues, etc. Right, some of these things cannot be avoided, but can be prevented through proper planning, training, etc., etc. I think those are questions that need to be raised with the sector department, just in terms of readiness. Each sector or department must be ready to be able to deal with this contingency issues from either. I mean, those are critical issues that are in the plans and so on and so on and so on. So again, it's not a matter that you've got to engage with yourself. And I'm saying, we've got to ourselves convene our own colleagues in the sector portfolio and start raising that we have a reservation, we've raised a reservation here, have left this here in our view. Maybe even the portfolio can explain this thing, or they would have accepted the reason for it. And so we would not dispute the reason for now. Because this process was done also at another level. Portfolios had been involved, accepted the reason, and so on and so on. Is anybody opposed to us then passing this adjusted appropriation? This 07 appropriation? Any opposition? Madam, please. Talk to the mic, madam.
I need to apologize.
Don't apologize. Yes. Talk to whatever you say. No, you don't want to say that. Madam, yeah, this is good. How full is it back?
No. It needs to be passed by them. You know,
we'll talk about that. Don't worry, the municipalities are catered for here.
Okay,
don't worry, this money cannot be received until you pass it today.
Okay.
It won't go. That's the bottom line. They will not receive it. And so, are you opposed to passing this thing so that the municipality will talk about the thing? Money?
No, I'm not opposed. I agree with it.
You move?
I agree.
Any second? No second. Oh, Mr. Colin is again. Well, look. There are huge challenges, you are right. What is also useful here is the issue of the extra money for the cost from it's a matter we're talking about only some things. But there are still some other matters which we want to look into ourselves. That's in respect on the Northwest education, there are some other things that are ongoing in education in terms of the number of educators and therefore the what I said in terms of the volume of the education. What I've seen by problems is over and almost all of it. So it's a huge problem. So Northwest is what I've seen 1 billion over 10 in pepper. Now it has to do with the cross-town condition. So clearly, if you're already dealing with that matter now, it is very artistic. So I'm just saying, I think it's a very serious that we want to do. All right, let's then take it. Okay.
As a person, I accept your ruling, but I think that going forward, we'll really have to find a way of handling this aspect, especially for people who are requesting additional funds, or people who perpetually come back, especially the Department of Public Enterprise, who come back every day and ask for more money, more money. And as Comrades were saying, that they have for more money this time, only to pay bonuses, millions of bonuses. I think that we really need to find a new way of approaching, of making them accountable before they maybe the might be asked for the reluctant to have shelter, that they must have access.
this is why I was saying in the third quarter, and it's supposed to be late. That's not around for the third quarter. So that as we go into the new batch, they must have convinced us and the treasury budget. If we're using the grand budget, and if it means talking to the grand budget and everybody concerned, that's crazy. In fact, the grand budget might want to revisit the issues that are raised in the MCBBS vis-à-vis these issues. So clearly there's a matter to raise them. Let's then say, Mr. Topon, can you, the issues you are raising in your statement that you shall have to deal with critical. But secondly, at the level of the process, I think part of the problem here is the congestion. We are highly on the side and what to do this thing today. Would want to engage with the culture. I mean, going into the future, maybe next year, let's talk about this with some quality to the power that we there also must be some engagement, proper engagement with the sector. It would be nice if the sector will meet you here at this event so that we can address this question to them. So nothing is another matter, but right now we are kind of congested. We also don't want to compromise the government in terms of the wealth. We want to share this. I'm not convinced by the reason. Okay. But then, thanks very much, Madam Ferreira. Let's take the dull taxation argument. You want to leave? You are our only legal advisor, but you can go. I'm sorry, you have put on that other. It's fine. No, that's fine. Young. For that.
From Treasury. Yeah. She's the chief of accounting.
I think will be increased as a result of the tax shifting. And it's a very smart that will be dealing with the technical aspect of the tax shifting. I think my presentation is general standard. I've been in the house before. The purpose of the tax treaty is twofold, it's both policy and administration. In terms of policy, it promotes economic growth by providing certainty on cross-border investment, and it prevents double taxation of the insane income through the provision of certainty on tax treatment and assignment of personal rights between the two countries. And then in terms of administration, which is third part, it helps in exchange of information and mutual agreement procedures. Coming to the tax treaty approval process, as we all know that we can negotiate the tax treaty and the president can sign. Without parliamentary approval, the tax treaty cannot come into force. Hence, it is important that we come to the House before the tax treaty can come into force, because as soon as they are approved by parliament, they become part of our domestic law and they are binding between the two countries. The tax treaties, they reflect the fundamental tax policy choices of its country, and you can find that a number of features reflected in the tax treaties are different from what is reflected in the domestic law. For instance, if a tax treaty between South Africa and Mozambique, you find that the withholding tax rate has been reduced because in Mozambique the withholding tax rate for dividends and interest are 20%, and the tax treaties have managed to reduce them to 8%. The text that is presented in the Select Committee today, they for approval process, they represent the best interests of South Africa. The aim of the text between South Africa and Mozambique is to strengthen the existing economic relations, and another thing is because Mozambique is a member of SADC. In terms of the SADC treaty and protocol, member countries have to sign text amongst each other, so we are adhering to that. This is a new tax treaty between South Africa and Mozambique. There has never been a tax treaty between the two countries, and this was signed on 18 September 2007. Coming to the investment flows between the two countries, South Africa is Mozambique's largest foreign direct investor. So far, South Africa has used the IGC as the primary catalyst for South African investment in Mozambique through government. So far, the IGC has approved funding for 10 projects in Mozambique and is currently considering other additional projects in the area of mining and mineral beneficiation, agriculture, tourism, chemicals, forestry, transport and infrastructure. Other major investments by other South African companies into Mozambique are Sasol Gas Pipeline Project, SAB Miller, Lobo Sugar, Sinapani Investment, CDM Investment, Mass Commerce Investment. As you can see, the values of those investments, they are in millions and billions, meaning that they are huge investments by South African companies in Mozambique. Coming to the South African money, the owned companies in Mozambique, so far there are over 100 South African companies operating in Mozambique, so you can see that the economic development between the two countries are continuing to grow. And the example of the companies operating in Mozambique is Sears, Vodacom, Shoprite, PEP, SAB Miller, Ilobo Sugar, Sasol, Standard Bank, Acamins, and the 5ETC. But when we researched the Mozambique investment into South Africa, we went through the embassy and the South African Chamber of Commerce, the Chamber of Commerce between South Africa and Mozambique. Apparently, the investments by Mozambique into South Africa are minimal, so they have not yet been recorded. Coming to the trade flows between the two countries, Mozambique is South Africa's second largest export market in the Southern Africa region, with trade balance currently favoring South Africa. The exports to Mozambique are as follows. In 2004, they were 5.7 billion, in 2005, 6.4 billion, and in 2006, 6.2 billion. However, the imports from Mozambique were 204 million in 2004, 199 million in 2005, and 318 million in 2006. So you can see that with regard to the trade flow, South Africa is exporting more to Mozambique than we're importing from them. Coming to the cross-border movement between the two countries, Mozambique migrant laborers are working in South African mines. These migrant laborers are regulated by the Labour Agreement signed between South Africa and Mozambique in 1994. So it's an old labour agreement between the two countries. You know that there is an exchange of tourists between the two countries. The students from Mozambique are studying in South African University, and people from Mozambique are doing shopping in South Africa. So yes, you can see that currently the economic development between the two countries are growing, so we think that the test will assist in the growth of the economic development between the two countries. Thank you.
I'll try to keep this brief. I mean, we've already been through the purposes of the treaties. Once again, this is something that I think members have seen before, and it's a standard slide for our tax treaties, just showing you how it assists in removing tax barriers between the two countries, and now into the specifics. This treaty has been a long while in coming, so you already had a preliminary briefing on this. Essentially, the treaty follows in broad outline the OECD Model Convention. Obviously, that is simply a model, so there are variations, and we'll just touch on the variations now. Okay, so permanent establishment for construction. In the OECD model, you would need to have a construction project lasting at least 12 months. In the UN model, it talks about 6 months. And you'll see in the South African Mozambique PTA, the BTC, we've gone with essentially the 6 month rule. There are some variations there, as you'll see, for consultancy services and professional services. We're talking about a 6 month project, we're talking about 180 days in a 12-month period. So essentially 6 months, but just measured slightly differently. International transport. Now, international transport, when we talk about things like ships and aircraft, because there's significant road and rail links with South Africa, international transport in this particular context can also be rail and road. So that's a slight variation from the standard. Dividends. Young has already touched on this one already. The withholding tax in the OECD model is 5-15%. Internationally, this is an area where there's a lot of negotiation. So, as we've referred here, we have a split rate. We have 8% where we have what's known as non-portfolio investment. That is where there's a substantial investment. So, then the withholding tax drops. And it's 15% in other cases where it's portfolio. Interest, there is just a standard 8%. South Africa does not have an interest withholding tax. Royalties, South Africa does have such an interest withholding tax of 12% at the moment. We've agreed here for a 5% withholding tax on royalties. Pension and annuities, this is a fairly standard clause. Where you have a social security system, normally that is only taxed by the country that is paying a pension out of the social security system. And then if you have any other kind of pension, then both states may be taxing it. Obviously with a credit for any taxpayer. Visiting professors and teachers, can we make provision for them so that we can have an interchange of education and thinking in this area? And so you see if you have a visiting professor being paid by a sort of sending country or the institution in the sending country, then it is exempt in South Africa or remotely depending where the destination is. Alright. Elimination of double taxation. Okay. Essentially an interesting point on this one is because you've got a grant, so you've got a government grant here, the government grant is not going to be taxed in another country, which makes sense again. Governments, if you don't like their money being funneled to another government. Assistance in recovery, this is quite an important one. It's something we try to get in our more recent treaties. Essentially what this does is it allows teachers with some administration to cooperate in order to collect taxes. So if you have somebody who owes SARS a lot of money and decides to quietly move to their holiday home in Mozambique so that we can't collect, we can ask the Mozambique Revenue Authority to assist us in collecting that tax and vice versa.
Wow, that's a record time. Carl is kind of done it, but thanks for the useful information. Questions, comments, VTA, Mozambique. Of course, there is some trade imbalances that you have seen, different countries.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks to the President as well. Chair. Rather a comment on the question. Okay, we've noticed some kind of consternation by our African countries to the extent that our country, South Africa, in some places is being branded as Big Brother. Jefferson, then I'm wondering, these trade agreements and so forth, what countries do need them? Okay, but I want us to reflect at some stage, you know? Especially the imbalance between the trade. To what extent does it lend itself to what one would be calling a colonialism of some kind?
what I would be calling third degree colonialism.
In the third, or what? The country is having its
leadership of the country thinks that they are in charge of their country, but effectively they are not, because they are not in charge of the economy of the country. And what should be forming the crux of your patriotic bourgeoisie are not your citizens, but foreign nationals. So, Chair, I'm not sure what would say. Chair,
I'm not sure
what
I don't know what kind of motivation. Remember, conference is around the corner. I can see it in his gearing up on that.
But, Chair, really, I just wanted to know what to do. Whether the checks and balances on our part as a country, as we assist our brother countries, what checks and balances are we putting in place in order not to be seen to be driving that kind of an agenda of a big brother? Thank you.
Well, we are a young brother in terms of age. But I personally would welcome the discussion, especially because most of these countries are out after some ravages of war, civil war and fair, even though some of them have been evacuated before us. And it has been this country that was the main country in the threat of ravaging those countries. And I think the new mentality is surely not big brother. But I think we would want to engage in that discussion in terms of reconstruction and developing Africa. And I think their part is to respond to that, Mr. Colin. But surely we are going to attack seriously against colonizing. You see, I think the discussion should not be negative, and Mr. Colin, if you mentioned that. There is this new imperative. And that imperative is about partnership. You're looking at, from the China growing opportunity going into Africa. It shouldn't be seen as colonialism or colonizing. It should be about equal relations, I think. And I think those are the kinds of issues we must be thinking about them as well as across the countries and Africa. Apologies. But it's going to be an exciting discussion. Let's talk about that.
I think it's interesting to have this understanding now of the investment projection by our country to Mozambique, particularly through this IGC. Because we grew up knowing very well that Mozambique has rich minerals like gas, bark and all that, you know, Tabora bark and all that. But now, if now when we start to gather things now, I think we also in the concept of NEPA, it makes sense. But I also want to check. I don't understand. There were two potential annuities. So social security system, are you talking in terms of our social security system? Because, well, one, we without raising what's called the sensitive situation of our people, xenophobia. Yeah, we talk about history of the xenophobia, and what's called sensitive matter. We know that our neighboring countries have quite a large number of people residing over that side, who always travel across the border to collect and all that. But I want to check, what does this really mean? Pensions and teachers, professionals? I want to get more sense. What does it mean? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I'm looking at number 19, it's about professors and teachers. So then there is a question of if we need teachers, we can teach our primary children.
You know, the Mozambican standard, children at a very young age, they can do almost all skills. Then it means that if we can get teachers from Mozambique, they can be exempt from paying tax in their country, and if they're coming to help us. That's the first question. The other one is the question of performance and willingness to work. But for the first, school them here, people who come from outside the country, they come in here and are willing to work. They work to find a sharing, the turbulence with our workers, the demand. How can we level the things with the workers? Because those who come from outside are not getting sort of a fair amount of training. And they, all of them.
Mr. Sokoni will respond to you and say, Karl Marx addressed that way back by thinking that the workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose except your chain. There can't be any evidence, Mr. Sokoni.
Now, Mr. President, I just wanted to remind Father that there is something they did not include in the trading between the two countries. That I see, I'm sure that I see to be there, right? I think Comrade Nkadisi from Mpumalanga knows it, the intermarriage between the two countries. It's not included here in the
question. Yeah, but on the side of not
talking about former
but we're dealing here with the target, the member of the target country. And I think that we have the SACU in this area. How are we going to deal with these things? I mean, with the general idea of the one, what you call it, Africa. I know that there are other, what you call it, there are other activities which are meant to break down these barriers between the countries. Are we going to deal with each member of SACU? In this way of the double taxation or what? Because I thought that the approach as members of regional trading or to call it a partner, the approach would be different from your Germany or what? How are we going to deal with this?
Okay. How are you feeling? How we can come to you? Is reminded.
No, I
think.
I'm not going there. But as much as you are interested in international trade, you know, that's where our country should be playing in this economy towards. But the INOT, given the trade between ourselves and Mozambique, calculated in American dollars, not the currency of South Africa or Mozambique, also has a bad appreciation. So if they would comment on that.
The mindset issue. And globalization, but for certain responsibility. Look, the issues of one currency that Mr. Sokoni talked about, that some of them are kind of being negotiated in the next year or two, some of those things are coming up. So I don't think we should be worried much about the other government, the burden. So that I think we shouldn't worry about it. Treasury should not really comment on that. But I'm just saying that there are those issues that ourselves must also be playing serious oversight on and raise sharply politically. How do we think about some of these issues? But as we do those things, we must also be mindful of the international setup. All right.
With respect to the first
understand. With regard to the question raised regarding Sadiqin trade, Sadiqin has different subcommittees that deal with all the issues in your region. For instance, a tech subcommittee, a trade subcommittee, also a customs. So they are dealing with the issues. For instance, you may find that electricity between the Sadiq region, we allow what is called tax sharing. Hence, setting the slide that government grants in order to in another country, something like that. So when you come to the Sadiq country, we become so lenient in other provisions of the tax treaty than when we are dealing with other countries outside the region. With regard to the trade imbalances, this has been raised before, but I think it's difficult for us as Federalist Committee on Trade because that is DTI policy. So I think DTI can comment later. So Frank is going to deal with the other questions.
Maybe I should not preempt because that the question was we are the Arab Union around Baku, your capital union, but we believe by this increasingly, I hope that you're going to.
There are two kinds of tax treaties. I mean, there's the bilateral, which is what you're dealing with here, two countries. You have the multilateral treaties, where you have a group of countries coming together. Double taxation agreements tend to be bilateral agreements, because each country's tax system is a little bit different. There's very rarely a common tax system across countries, so it makes it quite difficult. The closest you come to that is in the Scandinavian countries, where they have broad commonality, and so they are multilateral tax agreements. Again, now, when we talk about things like trade, on the other hand, there the rules tend to be a lot more consistent. And so there you tend to have multilateral agreements. So what you're going to see with SADC is a mix of both multilateral agreements and bilateral. Tax tends to be bilateral because the tax systems are unique to each country and need sort of a custom-made interface in the country so that you can get things right. Right. Social security, what does that mean in this context and the taxation of it? Well, at the moment, let's just take the state old age pension. I mean, that is a social security payment pension. And the question is, if somebody who receives that moves to Mozambique for a couple of years, who has the taxing right over that particular pension? And essentially the answer is South Africa, though, because it is South Africa's social security and paying that up. Okay? So South Africa retains the taxing right. Equivalently the other way around. If you have a pension that's being paid by government, social security, not pension, to somebody who is in South Africa, in Mozambique, would retain the tax. Now, at the moment, given the way the tax threshold is structured, people who are receiving state old age pension are below the tax threshold. So the question is a theoretical one right now, at least as far as South Africa is concerned. But remember, there was the announcement of looking into a social security going forward, a more comprehensive one. And so this is something one has to think about moving into the future. So that's essentially what's being done in that particular clause. On the teachers, really this is just for somebody who is coming across almost on loan. Okay, so they're still working for the university in Mozambique or their school in Mozambique, and they're being seconded across to South Africa for a period of up to 2 years. They're still being paid from Mozambique, and essentially what we're saying there is then the taxing rights remain with Mozambique. Likewise, for a South African professor or lecturer or teacher who's being sent to Mozambique, for whatever reason, perhaps to do some research there, perhaps to assist, and essentially then South Africa would retain the taxing rights. I think that's it. I don't really think I can comment on the turbulence and the difficulties people who sort of go across the border have. That's a much, much broader question.
I have already responded to that. no settlement. There's unity amongst workers. There's a brand new federation that is in form and is talked about ongoing in terms of the talks between the brand new federation.
Okay. Now, can we then propose, who's opposed to us ratifying and then agreeing to this treaty?
I see people caucusing. I see people looking at each other.
Who's opposed?
Do you have a reservation? Mr. Amkari? Reservation?
No.
And so? Make my way.
And therefore, Chairperson, I move for our adoption.
Thank you very much. And is there Mr. Agenda? Mr. Colwell, please make my way here. Then can I, then Mr. Colwell, throw this to you as a statement. Thank you, sir. And 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Thank you very much, Mr. Thomas and Diana. Then we shall then have some time for checks for the next 20 minutes. And then up to 5, then 15, 20, then 5, up to 20 to 12. And at 20 to 12, up to 12 o'clock, we shall be engaging.
Just unfortunately here we only have the hard copies because somebody failed to bring it across and I would have done that had I known, but anyway, we've got everything here. Make sure it's called, or it's not called 2007 appropriations. That's called Revenue Laws Amendments 2007, and we'll probably present it to Thomas F. and we'll try to get through this. Just to give you a little bit of background here, again, there's always two tax bills per year for your enjoyment. The first bill is rather the short one. It usually contains great thresholds in emergency matters. The second bill usually has the more complex issues, and that's what's before us today. This year, we tried to accelerate our process a little bit. We were partially successful. Normally, we get the bills to Parliament by October. Second one, this time we got their bills in September, but then we only got the process done in October, so here we are in November once again. So, but what it did allow us is for more comment time. Normally we've had about 2 weeks of comment time. We've now managed to get it about 4 weeks, and I think that helped quite a lot of the process. Our comments became a lot more extensive, it created a lot more work, but it allowed us to really think about a lot of things, and we made a lot of changes accordingly. And I think we still received a very strong consensus. If you were in the National Assembly, just by a bystander, we found that it was pretty much universal consensus on this bill. And I think that the consultation process is just in that regard when we tabled on the 30th. Okay, what's this bill all about? A lot of this bill is about a lot of corporate tax stuff. It's not maybe very exciting for many of us, but that's where the money is. So we've had to spend a fair amount of time with that. The way the bill, the essence of the bill turns on to your slide 3. I think the most important issue is around the FTC. Every time a company distributes dividends, it is subject to tax. And that is called the secondary tax on companies. We reduced the rate from 12.5% down to 10% to the extent that you've had dividends. That has gone into effect as of 1 October. But as a corresponding adjustment, what we've done is we have closed a lot of loopholes. So the goal is the guy who's taking the front door is going to get the 10% door. But the guys who are taking all the side doors, trying to get around the system, they will find that there is no side exit, that they're going to go out the front like everybody else. So it's a one process, everybody should be treated the same, 10% don't take the side door. The key thing is that there's lots of hidden side doors, and what this bill did was close them. So what you'll see there is on slide 14, basically an extremely standard transaction is taking place in the market, and that is oftentimes what people are doing is they're playing the sky scale game, and that's in slide 4. Where if you sell the business, you're subject to capital gain. Well, what they tried to do is avoid that capital gain. Of course, nobody wants to pay tax and hire their lawyers to get around them. And what they do, if you look at the slide, is instead of having a seller sell the shares to a purchaser of a company, what you do instead is the purchaser invests money into the target company, and then the target company takes that same money and pays it out to the seller. So instead of having a one-step transaction, they have a two-step transaction. And by doing that under old law, they managed to escape tax completely. Now, these transactions came in various forms. What we've done is we basically closed that leg. And we said, look, the extent that you're going to play games with us, we are going to treat that as capital gain event, which is going to give a tax charge of 10% to 14.5%. And therefore, we've closed that down. Now, there's a whole series of variations that have come with that. And what I'm showing you here on slide 4 and 5 is the basic structure, the two-step converted into one. There's a whole bunch of other amendments as well that come along with it, but that's all that you need to know on that. One of the big issues is the effective date. Now, for transactions going forward, this applies immediately. However, there's a lot of prior transactions between 2001 and 2007 that what they've done in these deals is by doing this two-step, they promised government that they would pay the tax on the sale, but later, much, much later, almost maybe 100 years later, 200 years later, maybe a planet what time later. What we've said is, no, you're going to pay the tax, and you should have paid the tax, so we will charge you as of 2011. We gave them a few years, think about the tax, collect the revenues. But they said they would promise to pay us eventually, they will pay us. And they don't quite like that proposal. But the bottom line is you will not escape the system. Franz, you want to take ordinary versus cap?
Thank you. Capital versus revenue. There's an academic paper out there somewhere that says that's probably the most litigated subject. That is page 3, slide 6. At the bottom, and then running on to slide 7. So this is an area where there's a great, because it's so dependent on how taxpayers behave, what they think, what their intention is, and that can be quite difficult getting into someone's head. There are quite a few court cases about, you know, which way, how do you determine what's going on inside someone's head, essentially. Now, in order to assist here, let me come back to the slide and slide 6. Then why do people worry about this? Well, the reason is simple. Once upon a time, capital gains weren't taxed at all. So that was great. You didn't pay tax if you could classify something as a capital gain. Now that tax is a lower rate. So again, there is still some attraction to trying to classify something that is revenue as capital, or if it's an expense, then to classify something that is capital as revenue. So what do we have? We have a rule that says if you held on to listed shares essentially for longer than 5 years, you could elect that they would be treated as being held as capital. So you had some certainty now. You didn't have to get into the mind of the taxpayer. You said, has it been held for 5 years? Do they want to have this treatment? If yes, then it was capital. Now, the problem here is that, first of all, that covered listed shares, but what about other shares? Okay. So essentially what's happened here is we've changed the system so that now it applies to a wider range of shares, so listed shares, unlisted domestic shares, members interested in close corporations and so forth, as you'll see on slide 7, and we've shortened the period. So now you only have to hold on to those shares for 3 years instead of 5 to get the capital treatment.
The one thing that has changed, though, is that whereas previously if you held the shares for longer than 5 years, you could decide whether you wanted to go capital or not. You had an election. Now it's automatic. If it is longer than 3 years, it is capital. If it is shorter than 3 years, we're still in the debate. What was in your mind? What was your intention? So the existing law doesn't change for shorter than 3 years. But over 3 years, the capital. Whether that means you're not going to get a capital loss, which you maybe don't like as a taxpayer, or it means that you're going to get a capital gain, which you think is great, that's still longer than 3 years on capital account. Moving then on to slide 8, just gets a bit technical, but the basic principles are reasonably simple, and the nature of the problem is set out on slide 8. Intellectual property can be difficult to deal with because it exists as a set of pieces of paper. And as Keith has said many times, lawyers love shuffling pieces of paper around, especially when it means they can get tax deduction. They move a piece of paper from one place to somewhere else, and you get a tax deduction, you're going to do it. So, essentially, how does this work? Somebody developed a nice piece of intellectual property in South Africa. Now, if you kept it here, you would be taxed on the income you earned from using that intellectual property. So, maybe that's not what you want to have happen. So, what can you do? Well, what you do is before the intellectual property gets too valuable, because you've proven its worth, you transfer it offshore to a friendly company, and you start paying that company for the right to use the intellectual property. So now think about it. You develop the intellectual property in South Africa and claim deductions for doing it. Then you transfer the intellectual property offshore when it's not worth too much, so you don't have to pay too much tax. And then you start paying a royalty offshore, so you get another deduction, which works very nicely. And then you have some kind of side agreements along the way so you can get your money back sometime in the future. So that doesn't strike us as too great an idea. So what we've got is essentially an anti-avoidance rule that kicks in, and that's on slide 9 on page 5, which says that where you have developed the intellectual property in South Africa and you transfer it offshore, we're going to eliminate your deduction. Okay? So that stops that particular game. Now, that's the one link to it. If South Africa does somehow manage to tax that income, perhaps because our controlled foreign company rules work, or because the withholding tax on different royalties is in operation, then you can either get a full deduction if it's taxed in full, or if the withholding tax is in operation, you'll get a partial tax because the withholding tax is a partial tax. And then finally, just to help close the gap for people who have come up with other innovative ideas that perhaps that particular rule doesn't cover, you'll all be aware we have transfer pricing rules, which ensure that when you price something across a border, the price is fair. Normally that applies when you have essentially a more than 50% interest in the company. In other words, the company on the other side owns 50% of the company in South Africa, or the company in South Africa owns more than 50% of the one overseas. And obviously we've got the rules for breaking up interest. Because of the way some of the side agreements and agreements in this area work, we reduce that 50% to 20% in this particular case, just to make it the rule a bit tougher. Remember, all the rule says, though, is that you've got to have a fair price. Okay, so as long as there's a fair price, we're happy. But what we're worried about is people charging unfair prices to try and fight the money out of the case. Keith, back to you, I think, was
one. Sounds good. Okay. So there's a little anti-avoidance to begin with. You always got to have a little of that. And very important stuff, because you lose a lot of revenue if you're not careful. One of the things that we have in the bill is a number of infrastructure kind of incentives. So again, remember, we're always trying to promote. We're trying to promote development of this country. Infrastructure is very important, and we try to give incentives for that investment. One of them that's very important is rolling stock. Now, rolling stock is trains and carriages. Rolling stock, that's what the word is, so think of trains, all that kind of stuff. And that's a fancy word for it. But rolling stock right now, you depreciate over 14, 15 years, which is a useful life. One of the things that's coming to notice, though, is that we're trying to promote the promote that kind of thing, because trains and carriages are far more effective methods of infrastructure and transport than, say, roads. Roads are a lot slower, you congest a lot of things, and you find that trains are very important when it comes to the primary area of the economy. And we're talking about coal, other raw resources, and other things. And one of the things that, unfortunately, is not just up to speed on that side. So what we've done here is we've reduced the depreciation rate down to a straight line over 5 years, so that there's accelerated depreciation, which means you get accelerated reduction. This is in line with planes and ships, but more importantly, it's in line with trucks. Trucks have a much shorter life as well. So the hope is that we will get investment, and we have commitments to that effect, and we will be getting a lot more investment in this area. And this is actually very important issues of productivity. There are issues around South Africa's productivity. When people talk about productivity, they think, oh, those lazy South Africans. That's not the problem. The problem is that you've got transport networks that's inefficient. And if that transport network is inefficient, it does make you less productive. Two, we have a problem that most of our value is inland cities. Most countries keep their cities on the ports. But one problem of being an ex-colony is the cities were set up for the benefit of the colonizers. What they wanted was extraction. So Johannesburg, Pretoria, while they're wonderful cities, they're not the best location. If you look at London, it's on the port. It's more efficient. So this is very important for promoting efficiency of infrastructure. And so I think this is widely supported. Turning over now to port infrastructure. It's another area that's very important. Now we do have good cities, which is Cape Town and Durban, to name a few. East London, I think, is on the port as well. That's where my wife was born. The issue is... Oh, yeah. So the port infrastructure, we've given some depreciation there as well, and there will be a 5% write-off. And some issues around fishermen and stuff that we'll discuss on a later date, but port infrastructure, widely defined, is going to be appreciable. Another one is turning on slide 12, and that is commercial buildings. Now, one of the things that we're doing, basically, is that right now, if you're talking about manufacturing buildings, you have 5% write-off. You've got a lot of infrastructure kind of buildings, 5% write-off. We're doing the same with commercial buildings as well. So there's a 5% write-up. One little bit of a political issue there is we're only giving most of these incentives to new and unused. We're not giving this to old stuff. That is a huge deadweight loss on the system. There's arguments that we should be giving it to old stuff. That is a big cost. And again, what we're trying to do is promote new infrastructure, not recycling of the old, because if you do that, as we discussed earlier, there'll be a bunch of papers that'll be shifting around. Papers will move. Nothing will change, and all of a sudden we'll have massive write-offs. That's not what we want. It's got to be new and unused. That is the slide 12. Slide 13 is environment. Environment's good stuff. Why is it taking us so long? Well, most of our rules are based off of a 1940, 50, 60 paradigm. And the way things work is that we design a regime around manufacturing assets or productive assets. Unfortunately, environment is not in itself a productive asset. It facilitates a productive asset. So the way the rules work under old law was that environmental assets received appreciation incentives sometimes yes, sometimes no, and it was sort of by happenstance. And that created a problem because we really want to promote environment. Increasingly, as you'll see more and more initiatives in this area. So what you'll see is that we promoted to the extent manufacturing has accelerated write-offs, you will see environmental manufacturing assets, to the extent they are closely associated with that process, they will be let off the same way at a 40-20-20 rate. That is sort of the recycling and the waste treatment, the treatment assets. There are things called the waste treatment assets, which are like the reservoirs and the dams. Those things aren't part of the manufacturing process. That's if you can't do anything with it. So those get a 5% write-off. The stuff that you can get rid of and clean up in the system right away gets more of an accelerated write-off. Again, this is for new and used. Those are basically what the incentives are about. I think those are important. Turning to slide 14 is cooperative banks.
Now, what is a cooperative bank? Well, your typical bank is your person that you guys, APSA, all those people that you're investing with. That's not what we're talking about, a cooperative bank. We're looking for a people's bank. We're looking really, we're thinking of as a rural bank. And unfortunately, if you're in the countryside, the big five banks, the big four plus whatever little guys come along, they are not there. And what you will find is that if you're in a rural community, that if you want to go to APSA, Ned Bank, Standard Bank, that you've got to drive about 20 kilometers away. That's going to cost you 16 rand by a taxi fee to get there, 16 rand to get back. You add the bank charges, there's another 5 or 6 rand. Before you know it, you're losing money by putting money in the bank. You might as well put it under your mattress. What the cooperative banks are trying to do is facilitate the relationship between the rural community and the local bank. And so they are really, they're owned by members of the community. And they're really not a non, they're really a not-for-profit kind of bank. What we've done last year is we promoted small business relief for most co-ops, but cooperative banks, the law was unclear. So what we've done is we basically said cooperative banks will get small business relief, which means the first 43,000 rand is exempt, then they get a 10% rate up to the next 300,000. You will see as a general matter, most of them don't go beyond this point. So this, you know, this is sufficient relief for them. I think there are further issues that have to be taken into account. Please note the Treasury of the Cooperative Bank Bill is trying to facilitate oversight, but also trying to facilitate actual support of these banks. And this was designed to help them in that way. That's 514. And in front, 515.
Sporting bodies. South Africans like sports, especially with men. Now, essentially, many sporting bodies are split into two arms. They've got a professional arm where the guys in big backs, they sort of are the people we root for in the stadiums. And then you've got the amateur arm, which is where you go on a Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon, and it's the actual people playing the game. Now, clearly the idea is that the youngsters and the people playing the game on an amateur level will start demonstrating that they're good at the game and may, some of them, be progressed into the professional side. Equally, people who enjoy the game at the amateur level will obviously also support the professional level. So there is a very close linkage between the two. But because of the way it works at the moment, the amateur game is essentially a public benefit organization. It's exempt from tax. The professional game, because it's professional, is taxable. Now that makes sense, but very frequently that the professional side wants to contribute towards the amateur side in order to help grow. And it can't claim a deduction for those contributions, right? Because the link is a bit too far apart between the two for it to be considered a business expense. So the suggestion here is we can allow them to merge so that they, once they join us, they become one entity, as many of them were before we made the amateur game tax exempt. What if they split at that point? Because they thought it would be a good idea. Now, a few years later, they discovered maybe it wasn't such a good idea. So we're allowing them to amalgamate once more. Once they're amalgamated, then that kind of funding of the amateur arm within this unified organization is deductible, and we proceed from that point. So this is really to help the amateur and professional arms come back together again, as many of them were, and then to allow them to fund the amateur side of the game. Slide 16. There are certain occupations that are pretty dangerous, where you can be killed in the line of duty. Think of something like the police force, some of the security industry, many others. And what does happen is that employers are willing to pay essentially a death benefit when someone is killed in the line of duty. What this provision simply does, it says, where you have such a payment from the employer that is over that the payment that is made in terms of the COIDA Act, Compensation for Occupational Injuries and Disease Act, then that is tax exempt. Okay, so that's a bit of assistance to people who are killed in the line of duty. And now I think I'll hand over to Keith. fit in for some of those really interesting corporate reorganizations.
Nothing like those company reorgs. Keep people excited at night. Just a quick background. Typically, when you see merger and acquisition activity, most countries have special relief for merger and acquisition activity. So to the extent one company takes over another, you generally get tax benefits such as a rollover relief. You don't get any special deductions. It's a rollover relief, which means that you can do your merger and acquisition tax-free. Any gain on that merger and acquisition is simply deferred. In order to get the benefit of that rollover relief, you cannot cash out. You can only be swapping shares around, essentially. Now, one of the things that we put in the original rules in order to prevent avoidance was we want a genuine merger of active businesses. And what we did to prevent inactive businesses or avoidance transactions is say that you cannot do a company reorg if it's got mostly financial instruments. And that seemed like a smart idea at the time, but over time we realized that this financial instrument anti-avoidance test has caused us nothing but headaches and it's got very little avoidance. So we're basically dropping this financial instrument test. So company reorgs can happen if they have mostly passive interest or active interest. And I think most taxpayers were welcoming this for quite some time. So this should simplify things quite a bit. And year after year, when we've been arguing before you, we've been talking about these rules. So at least you won't have to hear about them anymore. So at least they will facilitate the parliamentary discussion. So those will move on. The other one that we had a number of other reorganization rules in order to facilitate reorganization. I'm just highlighting the big ones here. That again, on slide 17, that was the removal of financial instrument test. The other big area is group relief. Now, what is a group? When you look at a company like Scappy, Barlow World, all these guys, they don't just have one legal entity. They have maybe 50 or 100 legal entities underneath them. And so you have one company with 90 subsidiaries, so forth. What the group rules do is say, look, all these subsidiaries are part of Barlow World. The fact that Barlow World has got 90 subsidiaries, it's still Barlow World. So you can move the assets around within that group, and any tax is simply deferred until the assets leave the group. And this is common amongst, increasingly common amongst more advanced tax systems. We have sort of gone halfway to the UK system now, basically. We've actually got a lot of the elements of the UK system that allows that flexibility. But one of the issues that's come around is, what is a group? Now, you know, you say, okay, well, that's pretty obvious to the naked eye, but by the time the lawyers get done, what is a group and what is not a group becomes a big issue. What we've done in the rules is two things. We've had a quid pro quo. We have narrowed what is the definition of a group, but we've also provided better relief for what is in the group. So right now, a group not only includes all South African companies, but includes all international companies. And includes a lot of exempt companies that shouldn't be there. What we've done is we've narrowed the group to say, look, you're part of one group from an economic sense. We'll respect that if you're also part of the same group from a tax point of view. We will only treat you as a group if you're a standard 29% taxable company. If you're all operating under the same tax regime from a policy point of view, as well as an administrative point of view. Because we need to know that we can collect as well as actually apply the law. And so we've narrowed that group definition, and it turns out there's been a lot of companies on the edge of this game. Some of the companies were not sure what was going on, other ones have taken advantage of being on the edge to actually strip out profits. And that shuts all of those down. To the benefit of the taxpayer, is what we've done is we've reduced something called a degrouping charge. When you degroup, all of those deferred gains for moving the assets around is suddenly triggered. So if you transfer to a subsidiary and the subsidiary leaves the group, we trigger gain. But the way the old rule worked is if the subsidiary broke apart from the group 1,000 years, 1,000,000 years later, we would trigger this charge. So the degrouping charge applies forever. And what we've done is we've narrowed it to say, if you do an intergroup transfer and the group breaks up within 6 years, you'll get the charge. But after 6 years, don't worry about it anymore. And that six-year rule, again, is borrowed from the UK. So we've actually made the rules better for the guys in the group. And that handles most of the people. It's just those guys on the edge that are not so happy. Now this, because there are a few unhappy people because they wanted the broader definition, We've given them a 1 January 2009 effective date to have the new rule in place. The reason why we gave a slight delay here is that you might have had a bigger group before, and some of the guys on the edge are suddenly going to have to be forced out of the group. And that's going to trigger a degrouping charge for them. And we want to give them an opportunity to get back in the group. Because most of these companies are having a problem now to simply move their assets and restructure and get within the narrower definition. It sometimes takes a little while, and we gave basically a year for that. Now, that's that issue. That's the last of the corporate rules. There's another number of other series of corporate rules that we've done. One of the main reasons we're doing this is also to promote a lot of the BEE transactions. A lot of BEE transactions require exotic forms of financing. And what we're trying to do is to make sure that the tax system doesn't pose any barriers to the financing that is needed in those BEE structures. This is, again, part of all of that. So turning over to the stamp duty UST, this is a lot of noise about nothing, but it's important that you see it. And that is, if you'll see before you don't have two bills, we decided to give you four bills this year. Maybe next year we can give you 8 or 10 just to keep multiplying. You enjoy creating bills. But two of your bills are revenue law amendment bills, and two of them are securities transfer taxes. The important point to know, again, this is slide 20, is that the two bills called securities transfer taxes are nothing new. You got pieces of paper there, but you are not enacting new taxes. Under current law, you have something called a stamp duty on shares, and you have an indirect charge on listed shares called the uncertificated securities tax. The reason for the difference? Shares on unlisted companies pay for share. When you go on the JSE, you don't get paper. Anybody, I don't know if anybody here owns any shares in the JSE. Your salary is anything like mine? Probably not. But if you imagine yourself being a rich person, you don't hold shares in a box. You basically have an electronic notification that says, these are your shares. So there's a different tax system for that. What we've done is we've taken the two separate taxes and merged them together. We have not increased the rate. We've kept them one simplified, same rate, put them two together in order to simplify everything, one set of rules. That's what slide 20 is about. Turning to slide 21, and that's probably the most important of all this stuff, is what is a security? Now, a security is a share, okay? And when we mean a share, we mean a share of a big company, or a little company, or even a member of interest in a closed corporation. All kinds of shares, including depository receipts, but it's all shares. We also apply the test if you try to play games with us. So, for instance, if you have a dividend cession, you keep the share, but you sell all your dividend rights. You say the transfer duty, the transfer tax applies. And basically what we've done is we've made a clearer, brighter line, and frankly, we've actually pushed the line back and narrowed it. So there's a lot of edge issues that we just said, look, if the share is a share, if it's something like a dividend cession, or a right to a capital, or a right to a distribution, you transfer that. Otherwise, don't worry about it. Under the old law, there are questions, do you have a transfer tax, if you apply a voting proxy and all this stuff, we've eliminated it. So mostly we've narrowed the definition, and we've consulted with the JSE, we've done this, and I think they're very pleased with the changes. Then turning to slide 22, who does this apply to? It applies to all South African companies, and it also applies to foreign companies to the extent they list on our JSE. So all of those foreign companies listed in the JSE, those shares are subject to the same charge because you don't want to get foreigners in undue benefits. That's what that's all about. That's basically very similar to the current law. And then the last is around 12 exemptions. And basically most of the exemptions are the same. There are certain things around divorce and community property. One thing I don't have here in the slides is just to state that if a company is newly formed and it issues shares, a new issue of shares, a new formation, is not subject to any of this charging. And that's because we want to promote company formation. In addition, if your company liquidates, you're also out of the system. If you don't want to charge somebody when you're on the way down, is liquidating out. What we removed was an exemption for closely held. Remember, certain companies are CCs. And we used to have special exemptions for those. We've removed those because the DTI is trying to get rid of the CC format. But because you give an exemption for formation and liquidation, most of your CCs, just the bulk of the transactions they're involved with. So it basically takes care of the smaller side. And that's all there is. And you're up to time again.
Right, we're slicing stuff on slide 24, the definition of customs and excise duties. Now, excise duties are those things we all pay on alcoholic beverages, cigarettes, and similar taxes. And customs are duties that are essentially duties that are imposed on imports. Now, what happens if you import a bottle of whiskey? Or let's make it more realistic, you import a container full of bottles of whiskey. Is that a customs duty or is that an excise duty on what's coming in? Well, internationally that's an excise duty. But our Customs and Excise Act regards it as a customs duty. So what we're doing is we're proposing that we align ourselves with the international consensus on this one, and so that excise duties imposed on imported products will still be classified as excise duties. So that's what that slide is all about. Slide 25 deals with counterfeit goods. So when people import fake products, you know, fake DVDs, shirts with little logos and crocodiles on them that aren't really from the right manufacturer. Now, at the moment, that customs authority in that area is regulated by two acts. It's regulated by the Counterfeit Goods Act and also by the Customs and Excise Act. The problem is that the two acts don't always fully align. So we've had a fair number of court cases, and our senior counsel told us we can expect a few more on some of those differences between the two acts. So essentially what's being proposed here is that we move the relevant provisions out of the Counterfeit Goods Act into the Customs and Excise Act. So we have one consistent set of rules. Now, this is going to have to be a two-stage process. What you're seeing in this particular set of rules is the first stage, the provisions in the Customs and Excise Act. We're interacting with DTI about changes to the Counterfeit Goods Act. And then once we've got the second stage of the process right, then both sets of amendments will come into operation. Slide 26. This is an interesting one. You'll recall I mentioned a little earlier, we have these rules that make sure that you have a fair price when goods or services are transferred across the border, okay, to make sure that people aren't stripping profits out of the South African tax system. Now, because of the technical way the definition works, it talks about what's known as an international agreement, which is an agreement between somebody in South Africa and somebody outside South Africa. Now, what happens if that agreement was concluded when both people were in South Africa and then one of them moved out? Is it still an international agreement? Because it talks about a cross-border agreement. So is it the agreement we're worrying about or the transaction? Well, clearly from a policy perspective, what we're worrying about is the transaction. So what this particular proposal does is it makes sure that the focus is on that transaction, the movement of the goods or the services across the border, not the agreement itself. A little technical point that we picked up. Slide 27. Employment abroad. If you work outside South Africa for more than 183 days in a year, 60 days of which you spend continuously outside of South Africa, you're exempt on your employment income that you get from that employment in South Africa. Okay, so if I go and work, well, I work for SARS, but we have an exception. Let's assume I work for one of a large corporation. It doesn't apply to government employees. I work for a large corporation, and I'm in South Africa, and I get seconded across to the London office for a year. Okay. Essentially, I'm out of the country for more than 183 days in a year. Let's assume I spend the whole year. I don't come back to South Africa for that year, and I'm more than 60 days outside the country. I'm exempt in South Africa on taxation on that. And you'll remember that in most of the DTAs, this is what 83-day couples, which is where the 183-day TA comes from as well. So it just aligns our domestic law a bit with international treaty concepts. Now, that's well and good for the salary I earn during that year in London. But what happens if in 6 months' time, when I come back to South Africa, I get a bonus? Ah, now, according to the logic of the exemption, I should get an exemption on the bonus too, because that relates to the period I was outside the country. Because of the way the wording is, I would be taxed on the bonus. And so we're just simply making sure that this kind of extra payment that you get that is linked to your period overseas, but that is paid to you later, gets the same treatment. That's what slide 27 is about. Slide 28 is the other way around. Now we've got somebody in the UK who's decided to come to South Africa. And typically, if my employer as a South African resident and employee gives me a house, I get taxed on the fringe benefit of getting this free house. Because, I mean, the employer can either pay me a salary, a nice generous salary hopefully, and I go and rent a house or buy a house, or they can pay me a slightly lower salary and give me a house to use. Okay, I mean, same either way, I'm getting a salary and I'm getting somewhere to stay. So there's a fringe benefit tax implication if your employer provides you housing. Now, that is based on the fact that there is an exception to that fringe benefit if you're simply away from your ordinary place of residence. So I live in Johannesburg, I come down to Cape Town, I get to stay in a hotel for a couple of days because I'm here in Parliament, and that isn't a fringe benefit because I'm here on business for a short period. Now, the arguments came up that somebody who works in London gets sent to South Africa for 5 years, still keeps their home overseas perhaps, but this is a temporary stay in South Africa. So the free house that they get from their South African employer should be tax exempt. That gives you a really odd result because if I, as a South African resident, got the free house, that's taxable, but because we have someone who's here for 5 years and they're going to go away again, their house isn't taxable. So what do we do about that? Now, essentially, this went to court because we took the position it had to be for a relatively short period. The judge said, well, I sympathize with your thinking, but there's nothing in the law that says it has to be. So you lose. And so we've come to Parliament and said, we think a one-year period in the country is reasonable. If you're going to be here for longer than a year, then you can start paying fringe benefits tax on the free house you're getting. This was extended from 183 days during the comments process. The 183 days was again based on treaty thinking. The one-year period that we're now looking at is based on SARS's original practice before the court case. Slide 29, and we're in the home stretch now. I'll try and do it fast. Dried maize. There's a split in how dried maize is taxed for that purpose, depending on what use of country puts it. It's going to be used for human consumption or animal consumption. Now, in reality, how do you know when you're the seller? You know, ask everyone what use are you going to put it to. So we're simply making it consistent. So it's zero rated either way. And then the final slide, slide 30, the ICC 2020 Cricket World Cup that we just had not too long ago. Essentially, what happens is that the ICC pays a grant across to the local organisers in order to get the event going. And essentially, what we're doing here is we're proposing that particular grant is zero rated, but that everything else that is associated with the tournament is standard rated. That's the normal rules apply. Because essentially, this is just a grant from the parent body to the local body to run the event. And so that's what Smart City is about. And, I think that brings us to the end of the presentation.
Thank you very much. You've done well. Considering that you were dealing with four pieces of legislation. But in terms of our discussion, there's only one piece, in terms of three pieces of legislation. I think the sequence is done also as a kind of achievement that's going to be made. And, we've got about 20 minutes for discussion, questions, etc. Comments and so on. You can talk to any of these. It's a choice.
Controversy Transfer, Administration Controversy Transfer, Business Revenue Law Amendment 2, Seven Amendment, Business Revenue Law Amendment 2.
Yeah, I'm just commenting on the deductions of tax relief with regard to depreciation of assets, especially when it comes to depreciation due to the environment. I think that is commendable. And in most of these new considerations and concessions, I see them playing towards the benefit of the emerging business sector. Because really, in one of these cases that was put before us, where depreciation was not considered due to environment, one had an experience about a printing workshop that started out there in what was then considered virgin territory, standing alone. But later on, some workshops, trucks, many other businesses came along, noisy businesses, and therefore that environment deteriorated. It was no longer conducive to efficient operation of the printers. It came about, it came before SARS for consideration of the situation, but it was not allowed. I'm very pleased with the new setup that takes this into account. But I noticed that several of these, they add to the benefit of the SMEs so that they grow, they don't suffer as a result of spending. But here, it's also very interesting to note how officers of SARS apply some of these rules and regulations, virtually thinking on their feet, but applying them correctly. Temperature.
The politician. No other questions, no other comments. Mr. Colin.
Yeah, Chairperson, when I look at it, I have this slide number 13, depreciation of environment and manufacturing patent. Though not manufacturing patent, I want to check where and how do you classify the situation of those abandoned mine dams, which all of a sudden are found productive due to the low price snow that is has gone up. Wow. What is the situation there?
Thank you, Chef. I think that you are right there. But the other question is around the intellectual property. My understanding is that now, if somebody decides to go overseas, not to go to a state, like other time frames, within which the person can do what he said, can continue to pay his entry and then what he has to pay his entry from state to state. I think the other positive from recognition is the cooperative care. Obviously, they are owned by small players, But the top of that how prevalent is this for the this benefit? And I assume that for ordinary people,
Starting at the beginning, on the
question of jump reclamation, which is, I think, the business where gold price has gone up, the fractional amounts of gold that are left in those dumps become economically recover. How does that tie into environmental depreciation? It ties into a certain extent. In a lot of that reprocessing of the dump is already something that the equipment you use for that would already probably be subject to over wear and tear about. But once you are finished with that process, you may in fact have an evaporation dam, something of that nature, where you do a final piece of processing before you put the soil back. Okay. And now, depending on how the manufacturing process worked, that might or might not have qualified, because this is now separate from the actual process of extracting the gold. It's now treating the product, that sand that you've now got that last bit of gold in that. Now you're moving it on, but that sand has to have cyanide in it. Okay, now you're going to need to get that cyanide out before you can put it away. So this will assist in that kind of area where you're doing that last bit of processing, you're doing that last intervention to make sure that what you're putting out of your factory, out of your manufacturing process, doesn't affect the environment. So it just makes sure that end to end you have the depreciation. It isn't something that falls out.
And it's related to the greenhouse gas project, the whole the water levels are being changed, and now there are imminent ways that affect the communities around the world. And no one is responsible. So I think that is the place to really make a good intervention.
It certainly helps whoever is finding fees and found to be responsible. The tax system then does fit in the property. On the question of intellectual property going overseas, and when it escapes taxation, we have a set of rules, the controlled foreign company rules and others, which try to stop people artificially gaining the system to avoid taxation. This particular amendment is simply aimed at stopping people claiming a deduction outside of the South African system of taxing offshore. If you took the intellectual property offshore legitimacy and you then licensed it out to the US and the UK and Australia and wherever else, then the normal rules would apply to that. This legislation didn't happen. But this is trying to stop these people to develop the stuff in South Africa, take it out and then charge us for what we're doing with it. That is what this is really aimed at. The question on the top-up debt benefit, how prevalent is this? To our knowledge, the police do this, and some players in the security industry do this. So we can only hope that this is something that would encourage that kind of behavior from the responsible employees. It certainly helps the employees. On the count for goods, the Customs and Excise Act is geared towards imports. Alright, where these goods are manufactured locally, the Customs and Excise Act comes into operation. Okay. So there are mechanisms in terms of that act that would assist right holders to take action against the customs. The employment abroad exemption, how does that fit in? Essentially, there are two things happening in that exemption. The first thing is that, as you correctly point out, there is a degree of alignment with double taxation. Because normally, if you're an employee who is in another country for longer than 180 days, the other country gets the right. Okay. So what we're saying is, well, then logically, perhaps South Africa should get go of the right. It also helps our employees become more competitive when we're dealing with a country that doesn't have a personal income tax system. So there are issues of competitiveness here as well. And then I should add just one last point. If a person is outside of the country for extended periods of time, you can make the argument that they're using less of our infrastructure and so they should have less tax. But I won't push that point too far. On the housing benefit, this really is about houses that the employer provides.
I mean, if you go out and buy your own house out of your own salary, that's fine. That doesn't affect you. The fringe benefit is all about free or cheap accommodation. On the drive made zero rating, essentially this helps the person selling the maize. You know, they don't have to track what is the maize. Maize meal remains zero rated and has been zero rated. The price, that's as far as the tax system can go to help keep the price down. But the tax system can't do more than that to keep the price down. As the price increases, there may be other interventions that, that may be desirable or not, but that is not something the tax system can really help with. We're not charging tax. We can't do more than that. That's pretty similar to the question of people who are sort of have two homes in two places, you know, one that they've been forced to rent and one that they own. Again, this is not something that is really going to help a lot on. And then just finally on the environmental, that's the last question. Well, sure.
I mean, I think you're asking that the National Environmental Act and what does it do. I mean, the bottom line is what we're trying to do here is promote companies to get the assets that reduce the environmental damage. The damage comes out when you know you have a factory and it's just producing the pollutants. The goal is to reduce those emissions at that entry point. And what we've done is we've basically given a depreciation incentive for them to get those assets. Now, in looking at it, the rules only apply to the extent that those assets are used to facilitate compliance with those acts. So all of those acts that are out there regulating, if you buy acts, you buy the acts needed to comply, that's what the depreciation incentive applies. However, it's important to note that this environmental thing is quite broad. You know, in order to get environmental emissions down, it's not just about getting the right equipment, it's also about penalties, it's also about carbon credits. There's a whole bunch of initiatives that have to happen in order to improve the environment. And I think what you'll see over time is the tax system will be coming at this thing from very different angles. So this is only one asset, it's designed from only one issue. We're trying to promote companies getting the assets to reduce those emissions costs. Just a point on the IP and the salary thing. I think you were trying to get at the question, what happens if I go abroad and I have intellectual property? This amendment, if you go abroad for more than 183 days, your salary is exempt. Your intellectual property revenue doesn't get the benefit. You develop it here, you tax here on that, whether you go abroad or not. So the two are different things entirely. I think those are it. Just a point on the housing about expats. Right now, we don't have many incentives for rural housing. But if you are somebody who goes and moves in your community, and you move to another community because of your job, say a mining company, and they give you a free house, as a general matter, you will have free benefits tax. There are some small relief. What the farmers are wanting is a huge relief. So they come in, they get that wonderful Meadows Estate complex, they stay there 5 years with their four-bedroom complex, with all the nice buildings and all the other things. They have been claiming exemption on all of that. Guy goes from one to another right now, they get nothing, or very little. And so what we're trying to do in this amendment is try to be fair. We don't want to put in tax on local people. We should be taxing the foreigners as well. Now, I know we're trying to promote skilled expats, so there's always an issue around that. But you've got to make sure that you're fair here. This amendment is about promoting fairness. And then the question is around housing issues. Well, that's a more difficult thing for the tax system to deal with when you're dealing with rural communities. In order for the tax system to really be involved, you have to have a tax base. People who are in rural communities, they're not generating much revenue. They don't have a tax base. There's very little the tax system can do. There's more things you can do, like on the VAT, where you zero rate. And even there, we're only talking about a 14% saving. When it comes to helping out the poor, the best thing is direct subsidy. But anyway, they issue an expat matter of fairness, the farmers don't get an undue advantage.
All right. Can I then put B42, B43, B44, and B45? Any opposition?
No.
Agreed? Thank you very much. Again, we're going to have one statement here, as I said earlier, on all of this. And we want to ask Mr. Mukaliki to take this one on our behalf. And then, lastly, let's send them the two presenters here. And we're just about to adjourn. But before we adjourn, there is, in fact, you are ladies, gentlemen and ladies, there is one last report. Which, what you can do then, we just want to allow members to have a look at this report from the SMC, and they will deal with it tomorrow. The meeting is adjourned.
Obviously, we're preparing to report to the council. What are the hours we're going to do? What are the hours we're going to do? Because I think that's not of the